This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, and welcome to this special edition of Power on Politics. I'm David Cochran, live from Parliament Hill, where the Liberal government has just tabled its eighth budget. We're going to break down how it affects you.
Mr. Speaker, we are acting today to ensure fairness for every generation. We are moving with purpose to help build more homes faster. We are making life cost less.
All right, let's start with the amount of new money going out the door. There is $52.9 billion in new spending in this budget over the next 5 years. So where is that money coming from? Well, the government is proposing to raise the capital gains tax on the wealthiest 0.13% of Canadians and on corporations. We'll dig into those details a bit later. Also, the economy is performing better than expected, and that means higher government revenues on everything from personal to corporate income tax. So where does that leave the federal deficit? Well, it's largely unchanged from the fall forecast of about $40 billion, and it's expected to stay below that in the years ahead. But there is still no projected path back to balance. At its core, this is a plan the Liberals say will help fix the housing crisis. As has been announced in the weeks leading up to today, the Liberals are proposing a $23 billion program to get nearly 4 million homes built between now and 2031. That's through $8 billion in new spending and $15 billion being put on the table for construction loans. There are also some nuggets in this budget to spur growth, including a new electric vehicle supply chain tax credit. It'll amount to a 10% credit on the cost of any building that builds EVs or builds the batteries and other components that power them. And the government is also announcing a long-awaited carbon rebate for small and medium-sized businesses. It will see $2.5 billion being delivered directly to 600,000 businesses. There's more. We'll go through it all. Power and Politics starts right now.
This budget is about fairness for every generation.
That was the Prime Minister and Finance Minister, Chrystia Freeland, just last hour, delivering a new federal budget that will hike taxes on the rich to cover billions in new spending. The opposition had this response just last hour.
Conservatives will vote against this wasteful inflationary budget. It is getting too hot and too expensive for Canadians.
None of our conditions have been respected, so we, of course, vote against it.
There's things in the budget that we fought for that are there. There's problems that we have. I want to hear what the plan is from the Prime Minister to address my concerns.
The budget falls far short of our hopes.
All right, the power panel is with me to kick off our special coverage of this year's federal budget. The Deputy Prime Minister will be joining us shortly. Emily Nicola is a columnist with Le Devoir. Michelle Cadario is a former Liberal campaign director. Kate Harrison is a Conservative political analyst. And Francoise Boivin is a former NDP MP. They all came into the studio the day that I'm not in the studio.
Of course.
So let's get your quick impressions of this. Francoise, because you're in studio today, let's start with you. Jagmeet Singh says he's not sure if he's going to vote for this. What's your sense of this budget?
Well, I just did an hour and a half en français there on the budget, and we were trying to see what the titles in the different media would be tomorrow. And it's pretty fascinating that we all were in a hype about the extension of the deficit. And technically, the fact that the deficit is actually close to what the Minister of Finance had claimed it would be, and even a bit under, might be one of the story. Yes, they spent a lot for the last 2 weeks. That's all we talked about. From the tones of the different opposition leaders, no surprise, the Bloc, of course, would go against because of the infringement in provincial jurisdiction. And the Conservatives, I would have been surprised if they said that, oh, we think it's fantastic. And for the NDP, well, they always claim, you know, what is good about the budget is because they push for it. What is not good in the budget is, you know, it's all the Liberals' fault. So all in all, no real huge surprise. But it's still very much a lot of spending and right. spending.
So Michelle, on that, the deficit targets, the financial track they committed to is staying in place, but it's because the economy did better than expected a year ago and delivered billions in extra revenue, and there's increases in taxes amounting to about $19 billion over the next 5 years due to a change of capital gains.
Yeah, you know, I think that they've done extremely well. They've got a document that I think will put a lot of energy into the Liberal caucus and probably into the Liberal Party. They've had a series of rollouts that led to today, which is a real wedge being put on the table about, you know, the Liberals are going to pay for some of this spending on needed resources, on needed priorities that Canadians have said in terms of affordability and housing. And you know, the way that they're going to pay for it is to tax the wealthiest of wealthy. Like 1/10 of 1% of the wealthiest people in Canada are going to pay a bit more. I think it's something that Canadians will be behind. And, you know, it sets up with the wedge with the Conservatives, who's always already come out and said that, you know, don't tax them.
Kate, the Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, Chrystia Freeland, is sitting down. She's getting wired up, but we just need to test that. So I'm going to get you to give me your quick 60-second take on where you think this budget will land with the Canadian public.
Yeah, I'm not sure Canadians think that there was necessarily a tax problem. I think that they perceive a spending problem. And a lot of what we've seen come out of the budget today, of course, is more spending. There's very little in there that is going to address immediate affordability issues. A lot of that spending, including future spending, is really only going to be realized midterm. If you think about housing and some of the other investments that are being made, there's very little in the immediate term that is going to help Canadians and their bottom lines. I also think it's important not to look at this capital gains tax in a bubble. Of course, these things have a downstream impact. You are sending a signal to entrepreneurs and to business owners about whether or not Canada is a place that you want to do business. So this is not a tax on big corporations. This is a tax on the innovators and entrepreneurs that the government says that they support. And of course, there will be a downstream impact in terms of how many of those people choose to stay in Canada and how many jobs they look to create.
Okay, Emily, I will come to you for your reaction, I promise. But I have to speak with my next guest first. Finance Minister, Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland is here with me now. Deputy Prime Minister, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for being with me.
I want to start with the capital gains tax changes. There has been some pushback from the business community already since this has happened, saying this sends the wrong signal. Directionally, it's a bad idea that capital now is being taxed at a higher rate than it was, and that this sends the wrong message to a country that has a productivity problem. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I want to say for everyone who is listening to us, something I said in the House, principal residences remain 100% free of any tax on capital gains. I think that's really, really important. Second thing I'll say is right behind us is a portrait of John Diefenbaker. And it was actually John Diefenbaker who first broached the idea of taxing capital gains in Canada. It was the Royal Commission under his prime ministership, chaired by Kenneth Carter, that came up with the notion we needed to tax capital gains. And what Ken Carter said is, a buck is a buck is a buck. The fact is, today in Canada, we have a tax system where it is possible for a nurse or a carpenter to pay a higher marginal rate of tax than a multimillionaire. And that just isn't fair. So, you know, this is about fairness. It's about fairness for Canadians. It's about generational fairness.
Right.
And it's also about being sure that the investments we make, and Canada needs investments. Canada urgently needs investments in housing, in affordability, in economic productivity. We know we need to do that. We believe in doing it in an economically responsible way. That means raising revenue. This is the fair way to do it. And this is the way to do it that maintains our competitiveness when it comes to business investment.
Right, but you know, coming into this, the argument was you needed to deal with the affordability and the housing crisis. You needed to maintain the fiscal track that you'd set for yourself on the fall economic
standard. And we've done those.
But you needed to deal with growth and productivity. This is the reaction so far from some economists we've spoken with and business leaders that there's not enough on the productivity side and that taxing capital gains like this may discourage investment and globally sends a signal that Canada maybe isn't the place for your money.
Well, if we want to talk about the global signal, let's be really clear that Canada continues to have the lowest marginal effective tax rate, known as METER, and that is the effective tax rate on each additional dollar invested in the economy. We are lower than any G7 country, lower than the OECD average. This tax measure was chosen to not affect the meter. When it comes to capital gains, at our new level, Canada is lower than California. We are lower than New York City. Those are two areas that attract a lot of investment, have a lot of innovation. I do agree we need to invest in the productive capacity of the country. We need to invest in innovation. That's why you see the investments in AI so important. That's why you see $5 billion invested in research, in universities, in postdocs, in students, and there's a lot more.
There is a lot of spending in this budget. There is extra revenue because of a better performing economy than projected on budget day last year, or even in the fall economic statement. And there is the revenue you anticipate to get from the capital gains. But almost all of that, if not all of it and more, gets spent. The spending pace of the government is driving debt servicing costs. It's going to go over 11% by the end of this forecast. It's $64 billion a year. How do you justify continuing to deficit spend at this rate?
Well, as you pointed out at the beginning, David, we set ourselves some very specific, very clear, time-limited fiscal guideposts in the fall economic statement. A lot of people you talk to had a lot of questions before the budget about whether we would meet those guideposts. We have. That is incredibly important because the governor of the Bank of Canada said having those guideposts in place was important to him, important in creating the conditions that will make it possible for interest rates to come down. We have done that. And I really want to emphasize, Canada today has the most fiscally responsible economic policy in the entire G7. We have the lowest deficit. We have the lowest debt. We have a AAA rating. That is the measure of the fiscal responsibility of this government. You talk about the investments we're making. I'm glad you are, David, because our country needs investments. We need to invest in housing. We need to invest in affordability. We need to invest in economic growth. And that is not, you know, some kind of eccentric partisan view. When we saw the budgets of BC, of Ontario, of Quebec, a progressive government, two center-right governments, all three made the decision that Canada right now is a growing country and needs investment. We agree. We're supporting their investments with infrastructure investments. We're making investments of our own. The only difference is, in contrast with those provinces, the federal government is making our investments in a fiscally responsible way, because that is fair, and that's about not saddling younger Canadians with debt.
Well, on that, I mean, British Columbia had a credit rating downgrade by the major rating agencies because of its spending and its debt levels, and people are looking at guests, I think, at what they're seeing in Ontario and Quebec on the conservative side of the political argument. You talk about this being about fairness for the next generation. By 28-29, $64 billion a year just in interest on servicing the debt. How is leaving an interest payment like that to the next generation fair to them?
It's a really important point to make, David, mm-hmm. that Canada's fiscal policy is not just a little bit more responsible than the rest of the G7. We are overwhelmingly the most fiscally responsible country right now. We said that we would have a declining debt to GDP ratio. We are showing that across the fiscal framework. That means our debt is getting smaller every single year. We said we would have a declining deficit. We are doing that. And to give people a little sense of things, this year we are saying our deficit will be 1.3% of GDP. In the United States, it is going to be well above 5%.
But they're a reserve currency in the global economic superpower.
Sure, that's why we are running a much more responsible fiscal policy. But we are not just more responsible than the U.S. Our debt and deficit are more responsible than Germany, than France, than the U.K., than Japan, than Italy. I mean, just look at the numbers. And you know, as I say, you don't... This is not like... there are issues where we can have a partisan debate,
yep.
where people can say, I believe in small government or I believe in bigger government. I believe in higher taxes or I believe in lower taxes. But truly, when it comes to the fiscal responsibility of our government, we are meeting our marks. The ratings agencies are recognizing that with a AAA rating. And I want Canadians to have the security that comes from knowing the necessary investments that Canadians need, the investments in housing, the investments in affordability, the investments in economic growth, the investments in fairness for all generations are based on a remarkably responsible fiscal foundation. That's the reality.
Let's just talk about that, the housing agenda. We got the strategy on Friday. It's all bundled together. It's about $23 billion combination of spending and loans, as I added up over the course of this framework. So much of it, though, are not levers that you can push and pull as a federal government. You need the provincial governments and municipal governments to be on board. But more importantly, Minister, at a time when you're dealing with immigration numbers that got too high under this government, you need a workforce to build these homes, and labor threatens to be a constraint on this agenda in the time frame that you've set out. How confident are you you can execute on this? Because the aspiration is clear, but the execution of it is not necessarily something you can completely control from here in Ottawa.
Sure, David. Like, you're totally right. We don't completely control housing. I described it today as a great national project. This is something that's going to take the federal government, provinces, municipalities, private sector, public sector. Everyone's going to have to pull together. But I have to say, I am extremely optimistic when it comes to housing. I think that over the past 6 months, as a country, we have really had a revolution in our thinking about housing. The main challenge with housing actually is not the money. It's not even the workforce. Those are both important things. The big challenge is the red tape and the zoning. We need to be a country that believes in getting more homes built and creates the conditions that allows Canadians to do that. And I have seen a transformation in how Canadians, in how municipalities, in how provinces, and just how people are thinking about it. People are embracing gentle density. People are saying, let's cut the red tape. Because I think Canadians feel, as probably you and I do, we want young Canadians. We want our younger brothers and sisters. We want our friends and neighbors. We want our kids and their friends to be able to afford a home of their own. That means we have to build more homes faster, and that is something our government is absolutely committed to doing.
Okay. There's $500 billion in your budget, so we could talk about this for a long time, but I know we're out of time. So Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland, thanks for taking the time to sit down with us.
Thanks a lot. Really nice to talk to you.
Thank you. All right. And that is Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland speaking about the budget that she just presented in the House of Commons, a little after 4 o'clock Eastern time. I want to go back to the power panel for more reaction. And Emily, as promised, I'm going to come back to you first. What are your thoughts on what you've read and what we just heard from the Deputy Prime Minister?
First of all, it was a masterclass in political communication. So I hope people took notes on how that interview was delivered beyond just the content of it. I do think it's interesting just because of how basically she flips questions around on, you know, the strengths and the weaknesses of her budget. For example, when it comes to productivity, I know that's a lot of what people had in mind in terms of what's lacking in the budget. She just flips it around and talks about what she is doing in her budget. And I think that's important for her to do. What I will say, though, is that a lot of the reactions that are coming out today reminds me of the measures that have been announced in last year's budget. For example, last year's budget was very much about, you know, the green transition in the United States and how Canada was going to respond to it by having investments specifically in businesses, making sure that people would adapt and that there would be productivity in Canada, not just for the next year, but also the next basically decade, and switching Canada's economy around for this new green economy. I'm summarizing what last year's budget was about. And it's interesting because today the reactions coming from the Canadian Business Association, the reactions coming as well from the other parties even, part of that is insisting on the fact that today's budget didn't do what last year's budget did, but nobody remembers what last year's budget did, essentially. And so last year's last year's were saying there's not enough measures for individuals struggling. This year's, it's all about individuals struggling, trying to find, you know, measures to help Gen Z and millennials. And we're saying, what about businesses? What about productivity? What about the economy? And so that's the thing that's very tricky politically for budgets, is that a lot of them has midterm, long-term action goals. And because we only remember them one year, we don't remember what was announced last year and the year before. We don't know that those plans are already in action, and we're not necessarily measuring as well. Even us in the media, we're not necessarily measuring whether or not we're on par in terms of what those things were that were promised to us were. And so because we don't remember, we think today that Christopher Freeland is not addressing things that she actually addressed last year, for better or for worse. But I think it's we need to remember that if we're going to address, you know, what's the gap and what's missing in today's budget.
Yeah, I think the criticism from the business community is broad-based productivity measures, and they don't like the increase in the broad-based PACs, but, and even some of those investment tax credits that were the centerpiece of the industrial policy in last year's budget. There's a new one this year, but a lot of the details and the enforcement of them still not clear. That's going to come later in this year. So there's still some clarity being sought there. Also, some clarity being sought by the New Democrats about this budget, because the Liberal government may not necessarily be able to rely on the NDP to pass this particular fiscal plan.
Is this a budget you will support?
So that's not a decision that we are making right now. And the reason for that is the following. While we fought for certain things in the budget that are very important, that are going to give relief to people, we have some serious concerns. And I want to hear from the Prime Minister what his plan is to address those concerns.
Okay, here to spell out those concerns is the man who's on the clip, NDP leader Jagmeet Singh. Mr. Singh, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
What is it exactly you don't like about this budget at this point, or need some clarity on?
Well, there's a number of things that we're concerned about. We are concerned that the disability benefit that folks living with disabilities have been waiting for a long time has come out at $200 a month. $200 is very insignificant, or not enough, to deal with the high cost of living that people are struggling with right now. So what's the plan to raise that up to an amount that is sufficient? What's the plan to address
that? Can I just ask you specifically on that? Because it's about $1 billion a year when you break it down, rising to a high of $1.4 billion, but not for another 5 or 6 years. The coalition of people looking for that in this budget, Neil Hetherington from the Daily Bread Food Bank, says it needs to be between $10 and $12 billion a year. When you look at their commitment to hitting their targets, do you think they can go that high? Is that what you want to see, or do you want to just see it bigger than it is right now?
Well, I know that the amount right now is just not good enough. So I want to know what their plan is around that. How are they going to raise it to the expectations that the people in the community have? And in fact, the reality is cost of living is so high. So what are they doing about that? We are proud of the things that we were able to force this government to do, but there's concerns. We were able to get the rental benefit in there to protect people who are worried about losing their homes. We're able to get the free diabetes medication and devices and free birth control. We're able to bring in that school lunch program, something that New Democrats have long fought for. But we are concerned about things like the 5,000 public sector employees that are being cut. How does that not mean cut to services for Canadians? So we're concerned about these things.
So on that, because for people at home who haven't seen this in the budget, there is a plan to reduce, through attrition, retirements and departures, the workforce from about 368,000 to 363,000 over a period of time. Now, there's been a growth in the public sector in Canada, you know, during the Liberal government's time. $5,000 jobs, if it's not direct layoffs, is a very small percentage of the total workforce. Do you think that is too much?
I just want to understand what the plan is, because we've been very critical of the outsourcing to private consulting firms, and that's hundreds of millions of dollars. So the government's outsourcing to that massive amount, which we should stop. We think the government should stop doing that. And then they're also getting rid of 5,000 workers. So make that make sense to us. We're concerned about that.
There's no windfall profits tax like you'd been advocating for. There's no wealth tax like you've been advocating for, though there is an increase in the inclusion rate for capital gains that will hit the wealthiest 0.13% and affect corporate earnings as well. What are your thoughts on that? This is something the business community is pushing back against. Where are you?
Well, we've said for a long time we want to see tax fairness, but our particular focus is this. We know that the major reason that the cost of living is up is because of corporate greed, whether it's the high cost of groceries, the fact that we pay some of the highest cell phone and internet fees in the world, whether you can't buy a home or rent a home, either because of speculators or corporate landlords that are both scooping up housing and driving up the cost of it. Corporate greed is a problem. And this was an opportunity in this budget to tackle corporate greed. and the Liberals failed to do so. We know the Conservatives will never do it, and now the Liberals have shown they're also not willing to go after corporate greed.
But is corporate greed really the underlying cause in, for example, housing affordability? I mean, you had this lack of supply in Toronto and in Vancouver in the last half of the last decade that led to people spreading out to the lower mainland of the GTA, which juiced prices there, and then measures were brought in to constrain that, and then the pandemic hit. Interest rates went way down, people saved some money, they started speculating on homes, and supply couldn't keep up, and now we're in an interest rate crisis that has hammered people. There's a lot more complicated factors going into any of these problems than corporate greed, as you say, or the carbon tax, as the Conservatives say.
Well, corporate greed is a significant factor. There's no question about it. If you look at the cost of housing compared to what people earn in terms of salary, that has gone up significantly, astronomically, really. And you look at speculation, and you look at corporate landlords that are really driving up the price of housing, scooping up affordable housing, it is a significant factor, and it's something that hasn't just happened overnight. It's been over a period of time,
right.
But it is a major reason. Economists agree that corporate greed in housing, in cell phone prices, in internet prices, in our grocery stores is a major driver of the cost of living. In fact, across the boards, economists have shown that inflation has been significantly contributed by corporate greed, using inflation as cover to drive up the cost of things.
You say you don't know how you're going to vote on this, but your supply and confidence agreement, unless something has happened, is still in place, and it says you have to support the government or will support the government on confidence votes as long as they adhere to the principle of no surprises. I don't think this budget would qualify as a surprise. I mean, is this something you could really vote against, or are you just going to try to get a little bit extra out of the government before you say yes?
We always have the right to withdraw our support at any point
sure.
in time. And so what right now we're saying is that there's some significant concerns we have. We are really worried about the failures to address corporate greed, the failures to explain how $200 is good enough for people living on with disabilities. So we're concerned about these things. I want to hear a clear explanation of what the path is to address these concerns from the Prime Minister before we make our decision.
Okay, clear explanations. I have to ask you about consumer carbon prices.
Sure.
Because I know that since your speech at the Broadband Institute last week, it has been the impression by a lot of people that the New Democrats are reconsidering their support for that. It hasn't changed at the moment, but you say you want to develop a comprehensive climate plan that is fairer to people and stops dividing people. Consumer carbon pricing has become very unpopular, whether you think it's a good idea or not. Are you reconsidering your support for that as your plan evolves? It sounds to me like you are.
Well, our position hasn't changed.
I get that.
And consumer pricing on carbon is just one part of it. What we've highlighted as a specific concern, for example, is that Canadians are saying it's unfair to us, especially since a recent report came out highlighting how much these subsidies are, that the federal government, the Liberal government, is giving billions of dollars in subsidies to highly profitable oil and gas companies. The report puts it at $18 billion. When they are not spending $14 billion that was earmarked to give Canadians heat pumps, to help with public transit, that's unfair.
I get
and that's
that.
A part of what we're saying is unfair.
But, you know, subsidies for fossil fuels, they've committed to phasing it out, you know, as part of their commitments to COP, so it's a question of that. And the other programs that aren't being spent, some of that is just the growing pains of, you know, execution of competent government that are challenges in every programs. But you gave that speech and made that statement. And look, you can move away. Wab Kanu has done this to commercial car pricing. Doesn't think it's something consumers should have to do, but industrial pricing is something that you have said could be used. But are you reconsidering your support? I know you haven't changed it yet, but you seem to be sending signals that maybe after David Eby has his election, you might have a plan that doesn't include carbon pricing.
Well, what we're saying is these are elements of the plan that we would put in as a New Democrats. We want a plan that is fair to working people, a plan that reduces our emissions. Ultimately, that's the whole goal. And a plan that takes on big polluters. That's what we want.
Right.
We should contrast that with conservatives who are fine with big polluters dumping into our waters, polluting as much as they want, polluting the air, the land, and the water. That's wrong. And the liberal approach, which is not feeling fair to consumers, fair to Canadians, fair to people, that's a problem as well.
But I'm happy to do the comparison with the other parties, but I need, I guess, a yes or a no on whether you're reconsidering the consumer carbon price, because it sounds to me like you are. And you know, a simple yes, and it's a legitimate position to have, given the division it is causing, and you don't want to lose popular support for climate action. So is that a correct assessment of where you are, that you know you have not changed your position right now, but you are reconsidering it and whether it fits into an NDP plan?
It is correct that we have not changed our position right now. That part is correct.
Yeah.
What we are proposing is a plan that should address these three elements that I laid out. That's what we want. We want a plan that's fair, that reduces emissions, that takes on big polluters. That's the plan we want to see.
Okay. Fair enough. How long are you going to give the government to give you clarity on the measures in the budget before you decide whether or not you're going to stick with them on this?
Well, we haven't made that decision yet, but we are going to raise these concerns directly with the Prime Minister, and we're looking for clear explanations.
Okay, so are we talking days, are we talking weeks, or could this, you know, the approval process for a budget, this could go into June, July, who knows how long. What's your sense of a timeline on this?
I guess the ball is going to be in the Prime Minister's court and the Liberals' court. They've got to explain to me how their lack of clarity around the $200 for people living with disabilities, the 5,000 workers being cut, the lack of a plan addressing the infrastructure gap for on indigenous housing and infrastructure. And we want to see why they're not addressing corporate greed as the major driver of the cost of living going up. So I want to hear some explanations on these.
Okay, and what's the timeline for when you're going to give us your comprehensive climate plan? Because there could be an election at any point, and you know, you say you have this middle ground. When are we going to see it?
You'll understand that we're not going to release our plan now.
A timeline, though.
But we will have our plan for the upcoming election on a number of fronts. We'll lay out what we want to do for Canadians to tackle corporate greed, build homes that are affordable, to bring down the price of groceries. So we'll have our plan. We've already laid out many of those elements, and we're going to lay out more as we get closer to an election.
Okay. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh. We're going to keep asking these questions about carbon pricing, but thank you very much for joining us today. Well, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre reacted to the budget in the House of Commons just last hour. He said, not surprisingly, Conservatives will vote against the Liberal government's budget. For the record, we did request that a Conservative MP come on the show tonight, but no one was made available. Here's the leader.
Here we have today a ninth consecutive deficit, with the budget still not balancing itself. And everything on which the Prime Minister spends gets worse and more costly. He has spent, and Canadians are broke. Conservatives will vote against this wasteful inflationary budget that is like a pyromaniac spraying gas on the inflationary fire that he lit. It is getting too hot and too expensive for Canadians, and that's why we need a carbon tax election to replace him with a common sense conservative government.
Okay, the power panel has been listening in on all of this, and they're back with me now. Françoise Boivin, Kate Harrison, Michelle Cadario, and Emily Nicola. Françoise, I'm not sure if Jagmeet Singh is going to have a carbon price in his climate plan or not, but he's also looking for some answers on changes potentially to the budget. What do you make of this move? I get the sense it's a repeat of what we've seen in the past, you know, some push and squeeze for negotiations and changes, but probably not a dire threat to the supply and confidence agreement.
Well, I didn't get a sense on either questions, even the carbon tax, but I don't want to go on that front because I don't have more explanation than he seemed to be trying to give you. But on the pushback against the government, it didn't sound very aggressive. It didn't sound very final. It sounded more like, I've got a few questions. I'll wait for the government to come back and answer those, and then we'll take our decision. I didn't feel that was somebody who was willing to bring his team on the warpath of a electoral campaign. So I suspect it's just he's playing the game. He's going to make a few days where the media will be looking at him to see what the NDP wants to do, what they will do, and so on and so forth. And then after that, they will support. I suspect we will see the Budget Implementation Act, which is, for me, much more interesting than a budget that is delivered in the House with lots of words, but nothing really concrete until the next step there, where we will see exactly the plan from, and that will be the fun that that begins.
Okay, we're waiting to find out what the NDP is going to do on this budget. We know that the Bloc Québécois is going to vote against it. Jean-Denis Garon is the Bloc's national revenue critic, and he joins me now. It's good to see you again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is the central issue with the Bloc in this budget? It seems to come down to jurisdiction, and the federal government's barging into Quebec's territory with this.
Yeah, well, as usual, I might say.
With billions of dollars, is that okay?
Well, you know, that's exactly the point. The point is not the amounts of money that are spent. The important point is how it's going to be spent. So this is a budget under the seal of centralization and on of intrusion within Quebec's fields of jurisdiction. So we have new conditions today in municipal zoning. Mm-hmm. They're even going to tell Hydro-Quebec how to tariff electricity with their clean energy subsidies. We have intrusions in terms of health with this dental care, with the pharmacare. Also, you're going to tell me that the money isn't all there, but the intent is there. So there is absolutely no way we can support that. And what we've been asking for a few days, and the government knew that, right, was for an opting out, the possibility to opt out for Quebec. We respect other provinces' preferences, but there should be an opting out option for Quebec, and it's not in there.
Well, it has been the historic pattern, though, of asymmetrical federalism, that, you know, the rest of Canada deals with whatever the government spells out and Quebec cuts a deal. And we've seen, you know, Alberta Premier Daniel Smith tabling legislation modeled on the legislation that exists in Quebec, suggesting that they want that sort of treatment, though not quite acknowledging that when Quebec cuts a deal on housing, for example, Quebec brings money to the table. So on dental care, is there a way to bridge that gap outside of a flat rejection? On pharmacare, is there a way to bridge that gap, or is it just a carve-out for Quebec?
Well, you know, Quebec is different, and we want the other provinces to acknowledge that. They can they have their own requests. They can do that as suits them. But, I mean, it's not total rejection, as you say. It's not how we see it. What we say is that if Quebec wants to offer Quebecers new services, new health services, the money should flow to Quebec. And the reason is simple. It's because we want to have those services delivered in an efficient way by the government that has the competence to do it. The federal government doesn't manage any hospitals. Well, there's a few exceptions, but yeah, it doesn't. Quebec does. We already have public dental care for children in Quebec. So now it's being enlarged within the federal program, but the infrastructure is there. Those dentists, they are already logged into this public system, so the infrastructure is there. So our goal, in the end, is to deliver services properly, efficiently, at a lower cost, and that's absolutely not what this budget will deliver Quebecers.
So Jagmeet Singh was just sitting there saying he's not prepared to support this budget at this time. He has some questions on a number of programs. You're reacting a lot like your leader.
Is this the time of the interview when we laugh?
So your leader did that, and I guess maybe you rehearsed this in Congress.
I'm sure that there's no NDP member of parliament that has their electoral signs in their cars right now.
So, well, you're not buying the threat whatsoever, right? I mean, this has been a pattern with Mr. Singh, that where he voices an initial skepticism about whatever the government announces and then tries to pressure to get some changes along the priority lines that he lays out. Do you anticipate that's where this is going, as opposed to a real threat to the confidence agreement?
Well, I mean, it's a budget that's already written in orange ink. I mean, you can see it. You can see all those programs. And the funny thing, and I think I've been, I told that to you last year, was that the money sometimes is not provisioned, but the intent is there. And I think the NDP, they're selling their credibility for not much.
What is your view on when the election will be? If it's not going to fall over this budget, the government sort of engineered its own demise in 2021,
yeah,
when it went early, saying we need to have a conversation about how do we spend coming out of COVID. If the NDP aren't going to abandon them, as you and your leader have suggested, do you think this goes all the way to October 2025? Do you think there's another budget in our future and then a full 18 months of this parliament?
I don't know. I don't know if the NDP is going to have the self-respect to have the election called earlier on. But I'm going to give you a politician's answer, but I actually mean it. Quebecers have a third way. They have a third way. They've decided to elect 32 bloc members of parliament last election, and we're the only province where people have this third way, and I think it's more important than ever. And I think that when the election will be called, Quebecers will be listening to the bloc a lot.
Do you have any concerns about where the Conservatives are in your province right now? I mean, they are trying to grow there, and they have made some gains broadly as they grow right across the country. They lead in basically every jurisdiction right now except Quebec.
But they don't lead in Quebec, and partly because they've been lying to Quebecers for a long time about the carbon tax that actually doesn't apply to Quebec. They've recognized it last week. So when I'm in my riding, when I'm on the field, when I'm listening, is people being fed up with being lied to. So I wish them good luck with their lies.
So look, outside of the jurisdictional issues, when you look at the actual intention of the programs and the overall spending priorities of the government, because, you know, set the social programs and jurisdiction aside, there's investment tax credits here for electric vehicle investments. This is something you're, you know, with Northvolt and others, your province wants to be a big player in. Do you see value in any of sort of the industrial policy laid out? And also, what are your thoughts on the capital gains tax increase?
Well, there's value in some of those measures that are within their fields of competences. But I mean, when we're talking about intrusions, it's not a minor thing. You know, people, what do they care about right now? They care about housing. They care about healthcare. They care about
they care about results, though.
They care about,
I think they're kind of tired of the jurisdictional squabbling.
And that's the point. Look at housing. They had this supposedly magnificent national housing strategy. Quebec's had been waiting for almost 4 years to have the money because we're the only province where we have permanent programs for building social housing. They didn't recognize it. They wanted to impose more conditions. And what do we have now? Poor people in the streets. You call that delivering services? I don't call it that.
But on the economic front, because that helps dealing with service delivery, Quebec is, you know, a green energy player. Yeah. Hydro-Quebec is an early mover on a lot of the green transition. What do you make of the merits of the electric vehicle credits and how that might help the economy?
I mean, those credits already existed. They're going to exist. I think there's a transition to be done. Mm-hmm. Quebec is way ahead. But you just told that Quebec is a leader in terms of green energy. Now what they're doing is that last year they've announced that provincial public utility companies could qualify for that green energy subsidy. Yep. Now they're laying out conditions and they're telling Hydro-Quebec, it's not a joke, I'm serious, they're telling Hydro-Quebec how to tariff Quebecers for its electricity.
If they want
how can
the
we vote
money?
For that? I mean, there's absolutely no circumstance under which any reasonable Quebec MP should vote for that budget. I can't even see that.
Okay. Well, the Prime Minister happens to be a Quebec MP, so I think he's probably going to vote for the budget. But obviously, and your bloc.
Maybe. I can tell you I'm disappointed.
Yeah, I got you. Jean-Denis Guérin, Bloc's National Revenue Critic. Always appreciate you taking the time on the fiscal aid. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, I want to bring back the power panel. Emily Nicolas, Michel Cadario, Kate Harrison, and Françoise Boivin. Michel, we've spoken to most of the major parties since we last came to you. What are your thoughts on what you've heard from the Deputy Prime Minister, the NDP leader, and the Bloc?
Well, it's kind of the three bears, you know. But on the left, they're pushing for more money. You should have spent more here. You should have, you know, raised more taxes. And on the right, they're saying, oh, you spent too much. You're raising taxes on corporations. So I think that the Liberals, that's pretty comfortable footing, you know. They put out a reasonable approach. They've made a choice in terms of their decisions of how they're going to fund it, in terms of a tenth of the top 1% that they're going to tax corporations and individuals. And, you know, now it's up to Canadians to decide. And I think the biggest question is, are Canadians' ears still open? You know, are they still, are they going to take this plan and see the investments that are being made in their priorities in terms of housing, in terms of tackling affordability, and appreciate how they're going to fund it in a responsible way that is the way that they actually plotted out in terms of those fiscal anchors. Mm-hmm. And are their ears still open to seeing what the actual contrasts are between the parties and just what Pierre Poilievre is talking about cutting and the consequences of that?
Right. So Kate, I want to talk, if I can, just a little bit more about the productivity agenda and the criticism of the lack of a productivity agenda. We'll be speaking to Goldie Hyder a little bit later in the show. And what the Deputy Prime Minister had to say about the capital gains increases. And for people at home, most of you, this is not going to hurt you on an individual level. It's an increase in the inclusion rate on profits north of $250,000. So you've got to sell an asset, make a profit of more than $250,000 before that extra rate, inclusion rate kicks in. But for companies, it applies on everything, not just on that. And her argument, Kate, was that this is about fairness, that you need that revenue to invest in a fairer economy and a fairer shake for the younger generation. The business community is pushing back, saying it's a bad directional signal, which I know is a point you made. What did you make of Chrystia Freeland's argument on how this should be seen?
Yeah, I think that there would be a little more understanding from the business community if there was any sense, David, that the government was looking at its own expenditures when they were thinking about fairness and who they choose to saddle with debt. The challenge, of course, is that the Liberals haven't done any of that. They've increased spending. They haven't taken a look at their own books in a meaningful way, besides a couple of reductions here and there. And meanwhile, they're expecting Corporate Canada and others to foot the bill. Again, I come back to the fact that I think if you ask Canadians, Canadians, there was not necessarily a tax problem. There is a spending problem. There was a Nanos poll a couple of weeks ago that pointed very clearly to Canadians' desires to see this government spend less. So they see the headline, which is more spending, more cost on servicing debt, and then they're not seeing immediate political or immediate consequence for that spending. What is somebody going to get tomorrow that they didn't have today as a result of this budget? So there's no kind of immediate political benefit to the Liberals to doing this. And to Michelle's point, I think Canadians have largely tuned out. I think, you know, there was a desire to have today be about a wedge for the Conservatives around this capital gains tax. I think that they've missed the mark on making it about kind of retail political sells that they can make to voters. And if a month from now the polling hasn't changed and the message is not sinking in about the housing initiatives and all the other spending that's going on, the Liberals do need to take a really hard look at whether or not it is the message or the messenger that Canadians aren't connecting with.
Well, that is the question, Emily, that they need to figure out. But I wonder if we can just talk about what Mr. Garon from the Bloc Québécois with his theatrical laugh about Jagmeet Singh and his support for the budget, which I appreciated. It's just for the comedic value of it. He makes the point that this is a lot of these measures that the Liberals are counting on to change the narrative and change the dynamic for them are an intrusion into provincial jurisdiction. And the argument has been that is no small thing. But you do see a lot of data in English Canada, which I know there are things different with Quebec, that people are tired of that and they just want results and outcomes. So I don't know if they're going to get the wedge on the carbon, the capital gains increases, as Kate was talking about. But this battle that is brewing with provinces and things over the other jurisdictional thing, is this an opportunity for them now that we've seen what their whole plan is here?
It might be a good way for them to connect directly to Canadians in provinces where that's the culture. I'm curious to see how this federal budget will play out in the prairies, where there's more of that. I guess the Bloc Québécois culture is now spreading out in the prairies, and I'm looking forward to see the reactions of the premiers there in terms of that implication in the provincial jurisdictions. But I do think that it's important to understand the context of the Bloc Québécois comment on this. Of course, it's a knee-jerk reaction for the Bloc to comment on federal government getting into Quebec's files. But at the same time, there is a specific context of the Parti Québécois being ahead in the polls in Quebec, and the Parti Québécois leader having just made a speech on how the Canadian government is threatening Quebec with literally erasure. Erasure is the term that he just used last weekend. And that's the conversation in Quebec right now, how people are seeing what Ottawa is doing, and especially the budget, as something that is basically a war on Quebec, according to the Parti Québécois. And that is something that, you know, François Legault was very much paying attention to. That looks like those are the two main political forces in Quebec right now, the CQ and the PQ, and the Bloc is very much aligned with that. And so it's not just the Bloc saying whatever the Bloc is. The Bloc is saying whatever it is. It's saying in this context of Quebec nationalism flame being fueled. And actually what Mr. Garon had to say sounded incredibly mild compared to what's happening provincially. And so that's a very strong signal here of something that might be to come, and in terms of the reaction to the federal budget, that might just not just be coming from the House of Commons, but actually from the National Assembly, and that's something that we'll be watching for as well.
Okay, that's a very important context for people to understand what's happening in Quebec. I want to show some data, if I can, about what's happening with the economy, because I think one of the surprises of this budget is that the economic performance was actually quite strong over the past 12 months, despite all of the turbulence that has existed in this country. They got the soft landing they were looking for, and it looks like they'll be sustained. So I want to show the GDP projections, if I can, of where things stand in the Canadian economy right now. If you look at where growth is projected to go, that is not a series of graphs that suggests the country is headed for a recession. Everything is staying above negative growth. It's positive, and it looks like it's building up to about 2% over the next couple of years. And there's even some suggestion that maybe the projections for the year ahead could be a little bit low. The second thing I want to show, if I can, is job numbers, because we have seen an uptick in we're going to show debt servicing costs. This is something to watch for. As they add debt to the bottom line here, and increase
increasing amount of annual spending is going to be taken up in debt servicing costs. And if you look at that out year, the 28-29 year, $64.3 billion a year. That is about 11%, a little over 11% of total government revenue that is going to servicing the interest on the debt. It was about $30 billion. Now, the government took on a lot of debt during COVID and the pandemic, but they've also built up a lot of debt just in their planned financial programs every single year. And lastly, I do want to show those job numbers, if I can. A sense of where things are going to be projected to go. Higher than unemployment rate, I think people would like, 6.3% for the next couple of years, and then not getting back below 6% until 2027. The job market looks a little bit surplus capacity there, but Michelle, why don't we start with you and just what you make of the sort of surprise economic performance there, better than I think a lot of people expected based on the way they felt over the past year, where the job market is going, and that looming bill coming due on debt servicing costs.
Yeah, you know, it is encouraging. And, you know, I think that combined with the inflation rate that was today, which is, you know, up a little bit, but not nearly as much as people feared. You know, signs that, you know, grocery prices, for example, the inflation rate is lower now. So I think that's important. And to put it in context, you know, certainly you want to keep your eye on the debt servicing rate. You know, 10 cents of every dollar, it's not how you want to necessarily have to spend your money. But to put that in perspective, you know, when we had to tackle the deficit, it was at 30 cents of every dollar. A full third of everything that was coming in was going out. And we didn't have that kind of growing economy. And that's when it was like a true crisis. So just to kind of keep it in perspective, you don't like to see the increase and the increased trajectory, but it's a moderate increased trajectory that I hope that they would keep an eye on. And I got to say that the GDP numbers are probably like the standout thing. And as I understand it, those are not just finance numbers, that they're still using what we put in place in terms of going to, you know, five economists and kind of doing a rolling average to come up with those numbers and to kind of give it some external credibility. So I think that we can have a little bit more faith in the credibility of those numbers as well. Let's just hope that we can get the job numbers up too, because that's what really counts in terms of families across the country.
Yeah, and Kate, Michelle is right. This is projections based on a consensus private sector forecast. These are not numbers the government could have put out with their thumb on the scale in any meaningful way. This is done by consulting, you know, a cadre of independent economists back in March. But, you know, the economy did better, I think, than everybody expected over the past 12 months. Seems to be that they have avoided the recession everybody feared. But the debt servicing costs are going to be high, and unemployment is sticky at close to 6%, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and I think Canadians are going to wonder, you know, what could we be spending on, or how much more benefit could be realized if we weren't paying those exorbitant debt servicing charges. My understanding is the entire revenue generated from the GST basically now goes to pay for the debt servicing charge for 24 and 25. We have eclipsed healthcare spending just in debt servicing charges. So, you know, when Canadians think about the impact on their day-to-day life, economic growth and GDP numbers are a nice to have, but it doesn't actually result in a real consequence for them when they go to renegotiate their mortgage, or when they're taking out a loan, and when they're dealing with those really high interest rates that are the result of inflationary spending. Mm-hmm. And just really quickly on unemployment, that is a very sticky number. I think the U.S. is a little bit closer to 3.1 or 3.2%. And when you take tax measures that penalize job creators, that is not sending the right signal to employers in this country about where they should look to invest here or the south of the border.
Yeah, the U.S. employment numbers are lower, but they calculate theirs slightly differently. So either you raise theirs by about 1% or lower ours by about 1%. But you're right, Kate. There is a 2 percentage point gap, however you calculate it, in the unemployment rate between the two countries at minimum. But, you know, Francoise, the argument you hear from a lot of people in the finance department that doesn't necessarily resonate at the kitchen tables is that, you know, the inflation numbers are maybe second best in the G7. The economic recovery is second best in the G7. People don't really compare themselves to France and Japan necessarily. They look at what's happening for them. And while there's been decent wage growth, you know, in excess 4-5% in a lot of months over the past year, inflation has eaten up so much of that buying power, people aren't necessarily feeling the benefits of those changes, that even if the economy is doing better, they don't feel like they're doing better. They got to redo their mortgages. And now this plan, so much of it, depends on other levels of government and a tight labor market to deliver on what the Liberals are promising here.
Totally. And on that front there, I was thinking it doesn't take that much for the public to change their attitude. Because remember, during pandemic, people were kind of comforted by their governments of every walk of life and feeling like we'll get over it. And then the economy was not that bad. We had the governor of the Bank of Canada saying interest rates will stay low. Then they jumped way high. That started some type of panic. Now, just imagine if they start going lower, like we're hearing through the grapevines, that maybe June, maybe. So what is going to happen in the next year? We talk about the service to the debt. I agree. It's humongous. We have to take a pause and reflect on that. But at the same time, remove a few percentage and it already has an impact. So all this being said, the growth, I kind of sense that people are a bit less, I can't say pissed off, but...
Well, you just did. And I think that works in both official languages. So go ahead.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Then they were like maybe 6 months ago. And that has to be the gamble that this government is taking, that their attitude will be a bit different. Because you're right. Most of the measures that they're talking about today, it's not going to be seen under this government, under the life of this government. And it might be scrapped by our next government. So I think that's the gamble they're taking. They want a position. They want to make it a battle of two, saying, here's our programs. Here's how we want to help people. And here are these guys on the other side who wants to cut everything and don't want to help anything. So it's going to be quite the battle.
Yeah, Emily, Francoise added another P to the show, P&P. I just wonder, there are no facts in the future, as my old bureau chief, Rob Russo, would remind us when we're speculating on how things will play out. But they have laid out a housing plan that, after being accused of having no plan, it's comprehensive. Whether it's achievable, we'll find out because of all the factors that are out there. And I guess the larger question is whether Canadians are willing to listen to a government that's been around and in power for a long time, and while a lot of these problems sort of took hold in society. So what's your sense of where they've left themselves now after this weeks-long reveal leading up to Budget Day? I have no idea what they're going to do to promote it tomorrow, but where do you think they are, at least in advancing their argument that they're not quite done yet?
Because last year, the budget and the announcement, frankly, all of last year, it seems like the Liberals were catching up. You know, they just woke up last summer, essentially, to the housing crisis. After their cabinet retreat, states started to take it seriously. Then now we're seeing some major action in the budget. Like it or not, there's some action. They woke up to the inflation crisis and specifically the affordability crisis as well last fall. And we then saw François-Philippe Champagne sit down with the major grocery leaders trying to say, okay, we're going to tackle grocery stores. Whether or not we like what they did, we started to see some movement and not just saying, but Canada's the best in the G7. You know, rhetoric, and Canada's doing better than our neighbors, rhetoric, as of last fall. Before that, there was a lot of denial in terms of how Justin Trudeau was tackling Pierre Poilievre's take on issues that Canada is broken. So now we're seeing some action. I said the one thing that is in the future that is not a certainty, but that could be a major game changer in terms of Canadian politics very soon, is the next forest fire season. It is predicted to be very, very intense. And I would like to see Pierre Poilievre trying to campaign on axe the tax, no carbon tax, while Canadians in Edmonton, Calgary, Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal, Moncton, like we've seen last summer, are literally smelling smoke as they're getting out of their houses. And so that's something that, you know, I'm not saying there's going to be an election anytime soon. I'm just saying that there could be actually, cynically, a window of opportunity for people to make move in the summer if you're worried about the right gaining some ground. If there was an election and Miss Canada literally being on fire, I think the ballot question and what people are looking for in terms of a political leader would change in that context of trying to vote for the adult in the room or the people that you're used to rather than necessarily looking for change, especially if that change is radical. And so we'll see. But I'm seeing actually the major factor for Kenyan political climate is the actual climate. So that's something to watch for.
Okay, that's going to have to be the last word. We're out of time, but I want to thank you all for sticking around for the full hour and indulging me as we talk to the politicians up here on Parliament Hill. So thank you so much, gang. We appreciate your insight as always. Thank you to the Power Panel, Emily Nicola, Michelle Cadario, Kate Harrison, and the potty mouth, Francois Boyan. Thanks, gang.
Sorry.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.